Okay.
Deanna, hi.
So, welcome everyone to our 11th, I think it is, right? Ella's nodding yes, our 11th session of the Author of Change Transformational Coaching Program. And I'm thrilled that we have more people in the house tonight than usual. And I'm just eager to answer your questions and to make sure that, you know, in the next 2 weeks, you get what you need to keep moving forward. Okay, so I'm going to hand it over, and you know, as always, I'm just here to answer your questions. So hit me up. And I know some of you are not caught up. That's okay. I would just say ask questions from wherever you are, and we'll just see what happens. Okay. Who wants to dig in? Everyone's so quiet.
We have stage fright.
No reason to have stage fright here.
I wanted to ask you a question. You've referred to a couple of people as your mentors. Mm-hmm. How did you obtain your mentors? How did you go about it? What did you look for?
So some of my mentors are not people that I work with one-on-one, just so I'm clear. So for instance, I consider Brendon Burchard a mentor. Now, I see him once a year in a smaller group, about 200 of us, when we do our certification for high performance coaching. Once in a while, I get to actually have a conversation with him. But because I'm with him a lot during the year, like I go to two or three different events, or sometimes four or five events a year, where he's training. And I have monthly programs with him where, you know, I'm in the programs and I can ask questions and all of that. I consider him a mentor. Now, how did I choose him as a mentor? With him, you know, he's in the same space as me. Like he's an author. He's a New York Times bestselling author. He is an online marketer. Matter of fact, he's one of the things he does is something called Experts Academy, which is all about marketing for people like all of us who want to be seen as experts in what we do. You know, is a writer, he's a blogger, he does video, he does all the things that I want to be able to do, and also that I teach, you know, in terms of, you know, getting at, you know, for nonfiction authors in particular, but even for novelists to get out there and be seen as, you know, knowledgeable on something, an authority on something, so that you can get out there and speak and blog and potentially get clients, sell products, services, all of that. So for me, that was what made him a mentor for me. Another person, well, and of course, I'm interested in personal growth. And that's the other thing that he does is personal growth. The other person I think of as a mentor is my friend and fellow coach, certified high performance coach, Charlie Caldwell. I chose Charlie for similar reasons. First of all, I really liked him as a person. He was always very willing to sit down with me and coach me on things without me paying him. We were just, you know, he just wanted to sincerely help. And I loved his desire to be, you know, to give, to really give to people and to help them. And Catherine, I'm going to mute you just because I can hear the background noise. Ella?
I'm sorry. Yes.
That's okay. Yeah, just mute when you and unmute when you want to talk. Sorry. I went with Catherine too. I don't know why. Anyway. So, and Charlie's a high performance coach. He does a lot on health and wealth and balance in your life, as well as the high performance work. And he's also enormously successful online. So for me, he was a great mentor because he's doing most of what I'm doing as well and has expertise. So I'm looking for someone, Deborah, who is similar to me in some ways, but beyond me, beyond, you know, my success level, that I can work with, who I know I can learn from and grow from and who will push me, right? So Charlie pushes me. Brendon, you know, I don't always have one-on-one with him for him to push me, but there are other ways where he's pushing all the time. So I want to be stretched and I want to learn and I want to grow. And so I'm just looking for people who are sort of in my space that can do that. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does.
Yeah. And so how did I find them? Well, Charlie, I found through Brendon's work. Brendon, I found through one of his books, and then somebody invited me to one of his events.
Okay.
So yeah.
Okay. That's good. Thank you. Okay.
Yeah. Why do you ask?
Because I've always felt like I needed a mentor mm-hmm. in the background somewhere that I could rely upon at certain times, but not all the time, and not too pushy or aggressive. And I've collected different posts that I've seen and this, that, and the other thing. And one of them talked about if to follow a person you really like their writing. Mm-hmm. Well, the one I would really like to write, like fiction, I'd like to write like she does. You know she's she hasn't time. She doesn't have time for anything but writing her own books. She's not interested. So anyway, it's just part of the journey. Mm-hmm. And I'm just was curious. And because you've mentioned these mentors, I just wanted to know your path and your thoughts.
Yeah. So, you know, in terms of writing, you could definitely find somebody who's just a writing mentor, you know, and yeah. I think in some cases we're paying them, right? They're coaches.
Oh yeah.
Right.
Oh yeah.
And in other cases, you know, I've heard my friend Charlie talk about his mentors, and a lot of them are people he's not in contact with at all. He just considers them a mentor. So like I could say Wayne Dyer was a mentor for me, right?
Because you're learning from their works.
Right. And I'm following him and I'm watching him and I'm, you know, absorbing yeah. not just what he teaches in his books, but how he lives his life and how he's out there in the world. And I mean, not anymore, but right. But I mean, I'll often say that I want to be a Wayne Dyer. I want to die doing what I love, you know, that I can't see myself retiring, that right. I would always be involved in some way. In
right. doing
this. So yeah, so I think that can be a mentor too. You know, this university, part of that was, you know, part of the desire to create this is to be a mentor.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Right. I mean, the coaching is obviously coaching, but it's there. I'm here to support, which I think is also mentorship.
Right.
To teach from what I've learned.
So right.
Somebody who can teach you from what they've learned from their experience is going to be a good mentor for you.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Very good. Thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Okay. Looks like Linda's joining us. Hi, Linda. Okay. Other questions. So we're just doing questions, Linda. So who else has a question? It can be about anything. Obviously mentorship was not something that's in our program, but again, I want to make sure that you all get what you need from this program before we're done. And we only have 2 more weeks. Well, 1 week after this one. So questions, speak on up, ladies. So how are you doing with the, let's check in there. I know some people have told me they're behind on the homework. That's okay. I would love it probably when the program's over, I'm going to send you an email asking for testimonials and also for your feedback, because every time I've run this program, people do get behind. And so a lot of what's in those homework assignments is ending up in my book. But it may be that for, you know, a week-long program, you know, 12-week program like this, that it's too much. So don't feel badly. You're not the first one to fall behind. And I'm not speaking to any one person in particular. But, you know, I'd love to have that feedback, too, when the time comes on, you know, what's been working, what hasn't been working. In any case, wherever you are, questions are appropriate. I think this week's, Ella would probably be able to tell us better. This week's assignment should have taken you into traditional publishing, I believe. Right, Ella? Yeah, you're still muted. You can just nod if that's all you wanted to say. Yeah. Okay. So do we have questions about traditional publishing? No. Mm-hmm. Okay. Linda, were you going to say something?
I was going to ask, what about publishing on Amazon? I haven't looked at the homework yet, so if I'm asking a question that's already there, you can just tell me.
No. That's so next week, I think, is self-publishing. Amazon, so here's the thing. If you publish using Amazon's platform, CreateSpace, Kindle Select, you are going to only be on Amazon. Now, I think everyone needs to be on Amazon because Amazon is the biggest player in the publishing, you know, world today. But remember that Amazon is primarily a search engine, right? You put something in there, you search, something comes up. Mm-hmm. So it functions exactly like a search engine. But it's, you know, the place where most people buy books these days. The bookstores are going by the wayside. And so it really is one of the primary ways to get our books sold. So I think we need to be on Amazon, but, and CreateSpace is where you're going to be publishing print books. So for anyone who doesn't know, we have Kindle, which is eBooks, and Kindle Select, which gives you 3 months exclusive with them. So that means you can't sell your book via Smashwords or iBooks or anything else. You have to be selling only on Amazon at that point. If you're blogging a book, I don't recommend Kindle Select because they are very likely to come back to you and say that you have to take your material off your blog because they want it to be exclusive. And if it's available somewhere else, they're not happy. Well, that's not the reason to blog a book, to take it down. So I would never say use Kindle Select if you're blogging a book, only Kindle. That said, I got an email today from somebody I know who published a book on CreateSpace, and they basically were questioning his content because it's available online, but not on his blog, on somebody else's. And so they were, you know, he's afraid he has to take it down. But usually if you can prove it's your content, then they don't care, except with the Kindle Select, because that's an exclusive deal for 3 months. You can only publish with them. I prefer, if you're going to self-publish, it's a little more work, but I prefer that you actually go with something like Ingram Spark. Ingram Spark will cost you a little bit more money, but Ingram Spark is very professional. They will put you in the Ingram catalog. And when you're in the Ingram catalog, or your book is in the Ingram catalog, a bookstore can then actually contact you, or not contact you, but a bookstore can order your book. So that means that if somebody comes into the bookstore and says, can I get, you know, Deanna's book? They'll say, well, we don't have it, because most self-published books are not in bookstores. But this could even be a Barnes & Noble. You know, they'll say, well, we don't carry it, but if it's in the Ingram catalog, we can order it for you. So let's say they order it and then they decide they don't want it. It'll probably go on the shelf unless it doesn't sell. If it doesn't sell over a period of time, it gets sent back, which is the only industry where publishing is the only industry where we have what they call remainders, which are the books that don't sell, and they get sent back to the publisher and then basically thrown away usually. Doesn't happen in any other industry where, you know, the stores buy something and then they can send it back. But anyway, Ingram Spark, you know, you're going to go through the same process. You're going to design a book cover, you know, you're going to hire a team, somebody who's going to design your book cover, someone who's going to design the interior of the book. You're going to hire editors. You're going to hire proofreaders. You might hire somebody to do an index. So you're going to have this team of people who help you put your book together after you write it. And then you're going to give the manuscript, you're going to upload the manuscript and the cover and all that stuff to Ingram Spark. Now, all of that's pretty much the same as with CreateSpace. But the thing with Ingram Spark is that you're not confined to CreateSpace, right? So I like it better, because then from there, they'll distribute wherever, you know, you ask to distribute it. And I don't know everything about their distribution mechanism, but I like that it can be in the stores. You can also upload an ebook, and they'll, you know, you can have it everywhere. But there are other options besides, you know, I mean, if you're not just doing a print book, then I would be looking at Smashwords, for instance, where for no money at all, I mean, they take a small percentage, but for no money at all, you can put your ebook up there and it will go everywhere except Amazon. And you have to upload it separately to Amazon. The other thing is, if you decide to use CreateSpace, which there's nothing really wrong with CreateSpace, especially since most books don't make it into bookstores, most self-published books, just make sure that you are buying your own ISBN numbers. So go to Bowker, buy your ISBN numbers. It's, if you think you're going to write more than one book, then buy a package of 10, I think it is. You know, you're going to pay like $200 or $300. I can't remember what it costs now. $200 or $300 for one ISBN number, but you can buy 10 for like $200. So buy 10 and give your company a name. You're going to be open. If you're going to self-publish, you're opening a publishing company. So give your company a name. Mine's called Pure Spirit Creations. And you have ISBN numbers that are related to your publishing company name. We call it an imprint. And that way, when you publish a book, I don't have one handy. Oh, yes, I do. When you publish your book here, see, it says Hay House down here on this one. It'll have your logo or the name of your company. Because if it says CreateSpace, and if somebody's researching books online and it says CreateSpace, they know that it's self-published right off the bat, which doesn't matter to the average reader, but in the publishing industry, it makes a difference. So that was a very long-winded answer. Did that cover what you needed, Linda?
Yes. So it sounds like you're saying it doesn't, if I go ahead and self-publish and have my own ISBN, it will be more respected than going with CreateSpace or Ingram Spark?
Well, no, Ingram Spark's going to be more respected in general. What will happen is, if you have your own ISBN number and your imprint, your company name, then it's harder for the average person to know that you've just self-published through CreateSpace. And so, yeah, that gives it a little more clout. The thing is that when you go to publish on CreateSpace, if you don't know these things, they're going to say, we'll sell you an ISBN number for $10 or something like that. And maybe it's more. It used to be 10. But if you do that, then what's going to be on the binding here, is on the spine, is going to be CreateSpace. Mm-hmm. And you don't want that.
Okay.
So that's why I say, at least, even if you're going to publish with CreateSpace, at least go to Bowker and buy yourself, you know, a minimum of one ISBN number, give yourself, you know, your publishing company a name, and go that route. I mean, your ebooks need ISBN numbers. Anything you're going to publish like that isn't just a lead magnet is going to need an ISBN number.
Okay.
Okay.
It's a lot.
What's an ISBN number represent, Nina?
It's the identifier for your book.
So it's like my creative property or something?
How books are identified.
Oh, okay.
It's just, you know, it's a, I can't remember what it stands for, but I was just about to stand up, but hold on.
Like what do you call those? Like a product code?
It'll have that too.
Oh.
It'll have a barcode as well. So, sorry, I was going to try to stand up. So, well, Brendan's, oh, well, this was the early, the Vance Reader copy. Hold on. Yeah, hang on. Let me stand up. Okay. I was just in the midst of doing that and I can't type anything or see anything very well. Okay, so here's the finished hardcover book of Brendan's, okay? And here on the back, it has a barcode,
mm-hmm.
Okay? But on the inside, on the copyright page, it's gonna have an ISBN number. I don't know if you guys can see that. Can you see that?
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay, and all those numbers that run after it, 109876, those go away as there are more additions, like as they reprint. Mm. Every time they reprint, they're going to knock one of these numbers off. But anyway, so the ISBN number, I was trying to get to that, hang on. international standard book number. So there are 10 digits and there are 13 digit ones. I don't know the difference between those. Anyway, it's just how we, oh, here it is, a unique numeric commercial book identifier. Okay, so if you do a lead magnet, like I said, then you don't need that because it's just you giving it away on your website, right? But if you plan to sell it, then you're going to want an ISBN number and you're going to want to, but for an ebook, I don't think you need the barcode. But, you know, the first book I self-published at the last minute, I had to find an ISBN number. I mean, not an ISBN number. I had the ISBN number, but the barcode. And I had a book, which I don't think I have anymore because I don't do the self-publishing myself anymore, but there was a book. And I looked through it and I found a place where you could actually buy the barcode and download it instantaneously. And I was so thrilled because I had a designer waiting to finish my cover, right? So anyway, but these are all things. So see, I think Linda, I think you were saying this a lot, right?
Right.
This is why I'm a big advocate of really having you understand what it takes to self-publish before you decide to go that route, because the majority of people are going to say to you, it's so easy to self-publish. Right? You'll make more money, you have more control, it's faster to market, all this stuff. It's all true. But you have to want to be a publisher. You have to want to take this on as a job because it's another job. So if you don't want to do blogging and you don't want to do websites and you don't want to do social media and all this other stuff, I always say, why would you want to then become a publisher? Right? Why would you want to have to manage a team of people and get a book to market? For me personally, I like the creative freedom of self-publishing, which I don't 100% have right now because all my self-publishing is done through my literary agent. I was the first author who had an imprint already, and so they took on my imprint and made it an imprint of theirs. So I'm with Fuse Literary. Their ebook division is called Short Fuse, and Pure Spirit Creations is a division or an imprint of Short Fuse. Because I said, hey, I already have an imprint. I don't want to give it up. And what if I ever want it back? Like, you know. Mm-hmm. But because of that, and because my literary agent, you know, basically approves whatever I'm doing, unless I'm going to give it away for free, I don't have a lot of leeway. You know, I can say I want to do my spiritual books now, and they're like, you know, you have to wait. Keep going. You may have a plan, right? But if you, on the other hand, decide to self-publish, which is what I was doing on my own prior to this, you can just say, I want to write that book. I want to write that spiritual book. I want to write this other book. It has nothing to do with this book, you know, but I want to write it. And you just do it. You write it and you publish it. Right?
Right.
But you have to want to hire an editor. You have to hire a second editor. You need a proofreader. You need the cover designer, all these things. And you may not know how to do all the stuff on Amazon either. It looks pretty easy, but they ask you some questions. And if you don't understand how to answer those questions, you know what I mean? Then your book may not be set up right. You also need what we call metadata, which is the description of the book. But if it's not done well, your book sales will not be good. So usually what I suggest to people is that if you have the money and you want to self-publish, that's the other thing, by the way, you need to have money to self-publish. Huh. Yeah, it's easy. Look, the guy who does my deck, he said to me, why are you telling people that it's so hard to self-publish a book? I help people self-publish books. He's the deck doctor. That's what he calls himself, the deck doctor. And he's helping people publish books. Well, yeah, you can do it that way, but are they going to be any good? No. So in my mind, you need to produce books that are as good as the traditional publishing books, which doesn't mean they're all great, doesn't mean they don't have errors, but they're produced by a team of professionals, right, who know what they're doing. And so to do that takes some money. And the biggest hunk of money is for editing. And if your book is not well edited, forget it. You know, people are going to start complaining on Amazon. You'll get bad reviews, or they will point out errors, like in an ebook. They'll point out errors to Amazon, and Amazon will cancel the book until you fix them.
Wow.
So Yeah. So you want to be sure that you have the money to do this because you need to hire all these people. And editing is the most expensive part of this. The cover and the interior design, not so much. People think it's really expensive. It doesn't have to be. But, and you have to have the time. Right. So what I usually, where I was going with this is I usually say, if you have some money beyond the editing piece, which you're going to have to do no matter what, hire a, excuse me, someone like, Carla King. Tell her I sent you, please. I don't know if we still have an affiliate agreement or a, you know, referral agreement, but Carla King is my go-to self-publishing person. And so, you know, if you want hand-holding through it and someone to take you through all the steps and do it for you, really, I mean, she's going to ask you to do the parts you have to do, like go buy ISBN numbers, but she will hand-hold you through and get you a cover and all those things, and you'll just pay one person, except maybe an editor. She may have some editors, though.
Nina, I've seen some self-published books, and the formatting looks really weird. It just looks like, I don't know, it doesn't look quite, well, it doesn't look very professional. I'm looking
Kindle or, at Kindle or print?
What'd you say?
Kindle books or print books?
Print books.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. And I'm looking at your How to Blog a Book, and I really like the format. Actually, I could see my book being presented in this exact kind of way. How did you go about getting this produced?
So that's traditionally published.
Okay.
So all I had to do was give them a manuscript and then do two rounds of editing with them mm-hmm. and two or three rounds of proofreading, because even though they have proofreaders, everyone, including the author, proofreads two or three times. Mm-hmm. It was a real pain in the butt, but it's part of the process I really hate. But they do that for you. So that's what I say. See, I personally feel the traditional publishing is easier because most authors just want to write. And so if you are willing to, as a nonfiction author, not as a fiction author, so Sherry's writing fiction, and I think Deborah's got fiction, but for nonfiction, a platform is essential. So if you're willing to at least build your platform, then traditional publishing affords you a professional team or a team of professionals who can produce your book for you. So you don't have to worry about that stuff. Now, they came to me and they said, this is the, you know, this is the cover, and Writer's Digest is, well, the publisher who used to be at Writer's Digest was enormously personable, I guess I would say. And he and I had an awesome relationship and we were always able to talk about things like the cover, but I didn't always have a full set, you know, actually I didn't have full say, but I could say, I don't like this particular thing. And then they would give me their argument for it. And I would say, okay, like with that book, I actually said, why is it light blue? Go to the publishing section, you know, books on writing and publishing. They're all red and, you know, bright yellow and, you know, they're bright colors. The response was, you know, I was like, I want it to be bright. His response was, every other book is bright. We want yours different. Hmm. Would I have known to do that? No. Hmm. Never would have thought of it. Hmm. Now, they made a mistake, though. If you look at the type on that edition, you have the old edition. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a new edition.
Oh, okay.
But that edition, the type is minuscule. And the reason was they didn't want the book to be more pages because they didn't want to increase the price. They were not sure. They had never done a book, any kind of technology book for writers. And they weren't sure it would sell. And they wanted it to be an impulse buy. So that first edition is only $12.99. Mm-hmm. And so they, you know, they were going for something in excess, or $11.99 or something. I can't even remember. But they, so they crammed it in, and then there were a lot of complaints about the type size. Huh. But to answer your question, I didn't have to do any of it other than turn out the manuscript and make whatever changes they wanted me to make. Mm-hmm. Back cover copy, all of that out of my hands.
And this is probably a silly question, but would a traditional publisher, does that automatically imply it's going to be in a book form, or can a traditional publisher also create something that would go online as well? I'm thinking about my audience and how they're very mobile, and I would want them, like, maybe it would be super cool if like Peace Corps sites use my book as like a textbook, but also for like individuals who are moving around, they should be able to pull it up on their computer or their phone. Would a traditional publisher produce two different formats?
Well, yeah. So I have a Kindle format as well. Mm-hmm. If that's what you're talking about.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, so they produce both for me. So I also didn't have to worry about that. Didn't have to worry about whether the Kindle formatting was correct or any of it. They did all of it. They put the metadata up, although I found some issues, like they had me in a category on Kindle that, or maybe it was the print book that I didn't understand, and it wasn't doing well in that category. And I went to them and I said, this is the wrong category. And they weren't just trying to get me ranked. I actually wasn't getting ranked there. But, you know, so they do all that. To me, traditional publishing, again, you get a team of professionals, you get some money up front, which I wouldn't say go spend it. It's really, you know, it's an advance. So they determine, they have a projection on how many sales they think the book will have, and that's based on the competitive analysis that you give them and what they also add to that. So they look at the books that have been published on the same topic and how many copies have sold. Now that's something you don't know. You know if it's a bestseller and that sort of thing, right? And so you give them that information and then they go and they research further and they see if there are any other books that were missing and they look to see how many books have sold. And if they believe a good number of books have sold, then they're more interested in your book. And then they project, okay, we think this many copies will sell of the book. And therefore, if we charge $19.99 for the book and we think you're going to sell 5,000 copies or 10,000 copies, we're going to give you an advance on sales. So that's what an advance is. It's an advance on projected sales of a book. Okay, so they say, okay, we think it could, you know, well, think about it. The average book sells 250 copies a year. 3,000 in its lifetime if it's lucky. I also heard the figure recently, $3,000 in its lifetime. So now you know why advances are so low, because most publishers are going, the likelihood is if this book doesn't take off on its own or if the author doesn't do a hell of a lot of work to sell this book, which most don't, we'll be lucky to make $3,000. So what are we going to give her? We'll give her two. So maybe we make 1,000. Right? Mm-hmm. Now, they're only giving you a percentage, though. So for every book, so that's the difference. Self-publishing, if you publish on Amazon, you're giving them a percentage, but it's a small percentage, and you make the rest. If you go traditional publishing, unless you go with a small publishing house, you need a literary agent. So the literary agent's going to take a percentage, the publisher is going to take a percentage, and you get a very minuscule amount. But they're your business partners, right? Yeah. So, I lost my train of thought. Oh, so I said you have this team of professionals and you get some money up front. So what I like about traditional publishing is somebody gives me some money for my time and effort. What if the book doesn't ever, what they call, earn back its advance? Let's say they give me $5,000 and it never makes $5,000. I get to keep my $5,000. Oh. But the agent doesn't make any more money. They got a percentage of my advance. And the publisher makes no more money. They only get their percentage, right? So it behooves everyone to earn back the advance and then some, right? Because I'm not going to make any more money. My agent's not going to, and nobody's making more money unless more books sell, which is why literary agents want to take on somebody that they know will help sell books, right? This is, they don't get paid up front. Literary agents get paid nothing. They work on commission. They don't call it commission, but that's what it is. If I'm making money, they're making money. If I'm not, then they're not. So like last year, I didn't turn in a book proposal. My agent made no money off of me. Well, he made some from you know, my royalties. So the books that actually sold and I've earned back the advance, we all got some money. Not a lot, but we got some. So, okay, but to go back to why to do it. So you have the professional team. You get money up front. That money, in my mind, is promotion money, right? But depending on what you get, maybe you get $3,000 and you put two towards promotion and you put 1,000 in your pocket for your work, right? At least you got paid something. I also believe that traditionally published books still have more clout. Why? Because somebody put their money behind you. So think about it this way, and I write about this in the author training manual, that a publisher is really an investment banker, right? You're going to them with a proposal for a product you want brought to market. And you want them to back that financially, and you want them to then produce the product and distribute it into the bookstores, right? So they're going to publish it and put it out there into bookstores. They want to work with someone who not only has an awesome idea and can produce their part of it, the manuscript, but also who is a good business partner, somebody who understands how books sell, wants to build platform, is willing to promote, right? Yeah. But let's say you do all that and the publisher says, yeah, we'll buy your, you know, we're going to give you a contract. You don't, you know, I mean, in every industry, if somebody is backing you financially, what it says is they believe in you. They believe in you and your product. And that is clout that you don't get with a self-published book. Doesn't mean there's no clout in a self-published book. I just think when you say, you know, I mean, for me, writing books about writing, to say Writer's Digest published them is a big deal. Right? So money up front, professional publishing team, some clout. And on top of that, you will likely be in a bookstore, which gives you additional exposure and clout. And besides that, you don't have to manage a publishing team. They manage you. And so you don't have to do as much work. Standards might be higher, might be harder, but so does that make sense to everyone?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So yep. I'm not saying don't self-publish. Don't get me wrong. I just want you to be very clear that publishing is another job. It's you becoming the publisher of your books and all that. It's project management, big time project management. And so if you don't want to do that, I suggest you build a platform and you try at least to get a traditional publisher. And then if you don't get a traditional publisher, you can always self-publish. But find out why the traditional publishers or the literary agents aren't taking you. If it's just that you don't have a platform, that's fixable. If it's that they don't think your idea is marketable, that's a different story.
And how would we find that out, what they're thinking?
Well, read the author training manual, because that was as close as I could get. I'm not trying to sell books. I'm just saying that is as close as I could get. The training writers to see through the eyes of a publishing professional.
Okay.
But with that said, the training in that book really is produce a business plan for your book. Mm-hmm. So let's say you want to self-publish and you want to know whether your book is actually marketable. Begin working on what we would call a book proposal, but it's really a business plan for the book, because the publishers are going to take your book proposal and turn it into a business plan. That's exactly what they do with the information you give them. It becomes part of their business plan. You've just done all the preliminary work and then they expand on it, okay? But do that. But when you put together the information, I don't care if you're writing a novel or you're writing nonfiction, do this. Go through that nonfiction book proposal as a process of evaluating your book idea. And at every step of the way, what you're asking is there a way for me to make my book more marketable, to make it more, you know, so it sells more, which means it has to target the market, right? And it has to be unique and necessary wherever it's going to, would show up at a bookstore, even if it's an online bookstore. Okay. So it has to fill a hole in the, on the shelf, as we always say, it has to be something different. So every step of the way, like you do a market analysis, you're trying to get really deep into what is it these people really want and need. Mm-hmm. What are their biggest concerns? What are their biggest questions? How am I addressing those? If it's fiction, you know, how fiction. So let's go to the competitive analysis, because for market for fiction, we usually know people want to be entertained and they like a certain topic or subject, or, you know, they like books on dog, you know, have dogs in them, whatever it is. We have the knitting authors, you know. So, you know, you kind of know what your audience wants. But then we go to the competitive analysis. And the competitive analysis is something most fiction writers never do, because there are tons and tons of novels out there. So, you know, they're like, why, you know, if I have a good story idea, what difference does it make? Question is, do you have a good story idea? You may think it's a good story idea, but if you don't ever look at what else has been written in that genre, whether it's romance or, you know, maybe it's Amish romances, and you decide you're going to write Amish romances, and they exist. And, you know, you go, if you don't go out and read a lot of, you know, of Amish romances, or at least spend some time looking on Amazon at their storylines, which you can see from their, you know, from the back cover or whatever, then you don't know if your storyline is unique. Does that make sense? So as you put together this business plan, no matter what you're writing, the competitive analysis is huge, because you can't tell how many books sold. You only know whether it's a bestseller or not in its category, right? But you can begin to look at the top, let's say, 10 books or 15 books in your category. So maybe it's business, or in your case, education, right? Or it could be travel, right? So you have to decide which category it goes in, and, you know, where would it be sold? And then you pick out the 10, 15, 20 top books, and you sit down with them and you figure out what's different about them than your book. What's good? What's bad? What should they have done that you could do? What did they do that you could do? What did they do that you would never do? Right? How are you going to produce the best book possible? And that's what the business plan is all about. It's about, from your perspective, it's about creating the most marketable book you can, to go through every step. And so there's like the author bio. So what does that have to do with anything? Well, it says who you are. If you're writing nonfiction, you want to make sure that you're looking at the bios of everybody else who's written books on your topic. How are you different? If they're all academics and you're not academic, that doesn't mean your book isn't any good, or that, you know, you shouldn't be writing it. Could be that that category needs a layperson to write a book. Right? So the whole so to answer your question, without reading the author training manual, sit down with a nonfiction book proposal template, whether it's mine or somebody else's, or a book on how to write book proposals. I have an ebook on it. And just go through each step and evaluate your book and say, how can I make this as marketable as I can? Will you know that it's marketable only based on the information you're gathering and your assessment if you self-publish? But if you feel pretty confident that, you know, that it is marketable, that it's a unique idea and it's necessary and all those things, and you want to traditionally publish, then you polish that business plan up into a formal book proposal and you send that off. But you're also evaluating yourself, not only with the bio, but for instance, there's a platform section. And that's where you're looking at it and going, oh, well, I only have 100 people on Twitter, and I only have 500 on Facebook, and, you know, that's it. And I don't have an email list yet. I don't even have a website. Okay, I better do some work before I submit this. Because even if you self-publish, you're not going to sell any books. Unless your book is just something so unique and necessary, it just, you know, goes viral. But that's few and far between. So, I don't know. At this point, I always feel like the rainmaker. You know, I just rain on everybody's parade.
So it feels more like full circle to me.
Good. Yeah, it's more meant to educate you, not to, I just hear so many stories of people go, oh, you know, self-publishing, everybody said self-publish, and then they go out there and they do it, and they come back and they say, I got halfway through and I quit. It was too hard. It was too much work. It was too much money. It was, yeah, you could slap something up there, but that's not going to get you where you want to go. So, yeah. Go ahead, Ella.
Thank you. This is a question related regarding categories. I just finished the query letter to be sent out to agents. And as I talked last week, on the bestseller list, a competitive book just came forward. But they're under the category of personal development. And my book I had under health and wellness. So I thought, well, I better... In my query letter, I better say my book is health and wellness, and I added all the statistics. And then I included, and personal development. Is that an unwise choice to have two categories, say those are my major markets, those two categories, and should I provide statistics for both?
So your book is probably going to end up only in one place in the bookstore. Because I have a literary agent, I can sometimes say, the two categories and leave a little question mark for him, you know, which one should it be? I think it's really this one, but it's only going to end up in one place. just because there is a, here's what I would do. I would probably take, if you didn't think your book was going to be in personal development and you thought it was going to be health and wellness, I would stick with that. And then I would have five competitive books in health and wellness. And then under complementary books, I would have this book, the one that's the bestseller. Because if you don't feel like it's direct competition, it's the same topic, but they're not coming at it as health and wellness, but as personal development, then it's complementary. Somebody could read his and yours. And that's actually a good thing, because you know how Amazon does it. You know, people who read this also bought that. And so that's you know, would be a good strategy. You're muted.
Yes. I still feel that this book under personal development is my direct competition. So I was wondering if maybe they try to strategize by putting it in a different category. Actually, my other big competitive book is also under self-help. So, and it's not under health and wellness.
Then so maybe kind of think, a, yeah, maybe you need to think about changing your category.
Quandary. Yes.
Yeah. So you know, what you could say is, I would pick one. The thing is, the publishers and the agents are going to pick it anyway in the end, but knowing that you've done some research on that, you know, will make a difference. So if you feel your book sincerely could be seen as personal development or self-help, then you could pick one of those and put it in there. If you're only doing that because these other books are there, then I wouldn't do that. You could put in there, you know, I feel strongly that this book would do well in the health and wellness category, but given its competition, it could do just as well in personal development. Okay? It's a little, you know, not being quite as firm about your decision as they might like you to be, but on the other hand, you don't want to negate the fact that that might be where they want to put you, and you also want it to make sense that your competition is somewhere else, and you know, you're thinking about that. So I would be, if you really feel like you need to have both in there, I would have at the very top of the competitive analysis where you say, I think it'll be in this category, I would say, you know, I have 10 books that are, you know, or 5 books that are my top competition. And although, you know, my book would fit really well into health and wellness, these other, you know, the two of the top books in my competitive analysis are in personal development or self-help, and therefore, you know, my book could easily fit there. Make sense? Okay. All right, are you good? Because you're muted still. Does that make sense?
Yes, that helps a lot. Thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah, it's not always the best way to go, but I have done that.
Okay.
So, okay?
All right, thank you.
You're welcome. All right, other questions?
In regards to category, you've mentioned you've been wanting to do spiritual books. And it sounds like they've been holding you off. I'm wondering why.
So, platform. That's the that would be the main reason. So when I approached my current agent, I told him I thought he'd think I was crazy, and I showed him this. I could only print out this minuscule. I used FreeMind to make a mind map of all the different books that I wanted to write, and when I printed it, it was this tiny little thing because you know how FreeMind is; it doesn't print it. So anyway, and I gave it to him, and I said, "You're gonna think I'm crazy. I have like 20 books." And not all of them are in the same category. Like they're all over the place. There are writing and publishing ones, and there are some blogging ones, but then there's this whole personal development, spiritual woo-woo side that I really, really want to do. And that's how I started out, actually. I started out doing that, and if you were to go to ninaamir.com, you'll see that there are some PDF-type ebooks that you can you can buy there. And on Amazon, I have 2 or 3 spiritual books, actually. Anyway, so he came back to me and said, I think it was like a 5-year plan or something, which we've gotten off track on because of me. But basically the idea was let's build let's keep going with the writing books, but in a way that leads us to personal development. And of course, being a high performance coach has helped. But if you look at the author training manual, it has one or two chapters, I can't even remember, that are all about evaluating yourself. That's personal development. The whole author attitude, willingness, optimism, objectivity and tenacity all falls into the personal development category, right?
Mm-hmm.
My new book, Author of Change, has a, I have to be very generic with it, but has a spiritual component, because a lot of people, you know, are activists for spiritual reasons and for, because of their values, and, you know, they have a strong sense of purpose. So it takes me into a different realm of writing. And from there, we're supposed to keep moving in that direction. But every time I've come to my agent and said, you know, I really am getting bored, I really want to write those other books, you know, he's like, we have a plan and we're sticking to it. Because in his mind, it's a matter of building platform. And sometimes the platform is books. But it's also my blog, which the Nina Amir blog was not left stagnant totally, but was kind of ignored, you know, not well taken care of for many years while I did all the writing and publishing books, because I was building platform there. Well, so now that blog has actually grown more than 50% in the last year. And I'm about to start a podcast. And so the more I do to be in the personal development realm and spiritual realm, the more those books will come to pass. So I don't know if that answers your question very well, but that's, there's a plan for me to build platform towards that. And I had a deal, not a deal, but I had an opportunity to pitch to Sounds True, which only does spiritual books. And I happened to speak at a conference where acquisitions editor heard me say I wanted to do spiritual books, and she liked my speaking style, and they do a lot of audio, you know, and she asked me to pitch. And so we did. And they were very excited. And then they didn't take the proposal. They didn't like the way it was structured. And we went back and said, we can restructure it a different way. They said, no, we'd like to actually get Nina on the phone. And this is sort of unheard of. They had three people from Sounds True on the phone with me and my agent, or my agent and me. And we threw around a bunch of ideas, and I had one that they said, we can tell you're really excited about this one. Let's do that. And I sent them that proposal too, and they declined. And when my agent talked to me about it, he said, we knew this was 2 years too early. He said, you still need to work on that platform in that direction in order to be able to land this kind of a publisher, because Sounds True is a much bigger publisher. And he said, but they're interested in you, and that's good to know. And, you know, now we keep building. And so this is where I usually say to people, you may have this book you really, really want to write. It is the book for you. But you have no track record. You don't have much of a platform. Doing that book first could be okay, could sell, could be successful. On the other hand, it could flop because you have nothing else out there in the world. So sometimes it's better to do the smaller books first, right? And build to the big book. So I have a big book that I've wanted to write for probably 20 years, 15, 20 years. And I have a small version of it, a little short book that you can get off my website. But that book has morphed in my mind and, you know, whatever. And it will probably be one of the later books we do for that reason. Because my agent said it's totally tied into my branding. And he said, you know, that book needs to be done when we can go big. And that's the advantage of an agent. A good agent is one who directs you. So am I always happy, Linda? No. Sometimes I'm quite unhappy. But I love having a partner who can look at my whole career and say, this is what we need to do next.
I think it also, though, points out to us just how important the platform is. I mean, hearing you talk about the platform for all these weeks and knowing that we need to really work on that is setting in, but also recognizing that, you know, they are telling you to hold off because of the platform not being fully built, just puts that much more emphasis and importance on it. And so, you know, it takes us a layer deeper, I think, if that's what I'm trying to say.
Well, that's why I like to tell those stories. You know, it's like the Sounds True story. Yeah, I mean, it's not about me saying, oh, hey, look, Sounds True wanted to talk to me. It's, hey, they did. But according to my agent, the reason I probably didn't get the deal with them, even though they were so excited about working with me, was because my platform's still not big enough for them. So, yeah, this is enormously important. And I don't care if you're writing fiction or nonfiction. With fiction, if you want to go the traditional publishing route or even self-publish, it's not a requirement. But if you have an author with a platform and an author with no platform who both, so let's say, self-publish a novel, which one is likely to get more traction in the marketplace? One that has a built-in readership,
so meaning Nina, a platform. Literally not writing on that book? I mean, are you, so let's say your agent says in 5 years, it'll be the time. So are you going to then wait 5 years to then write it, or do you write it anyway, but don't bring it out until 5 years? Like, will the idea stay with you?
Yeah, that's a really, really great question, Deanna. I actually, from a very spiritual perspective and maybe a very metaphysical and woo-woo perspective, believe that Sounds True didn't take me, not so much because of the platform, but because energetically, I was not immersed in those ideas anymore. Mm. Like, I'd had them all. I had worked with them. I had little pieces of them done, but I really wasn't, from a spiritual perspective, working with that. Mm-hmm. You know, because I've been so focused on the other stuff. And so I walked away and went, okay, I really have to immerse myself in these topics again, which has to do with my daily outlook and practice and all of that. Right. Mm-hmm. But to go back to your question more specifically, I can tell you that when I spoke to Sounds True, I definitely had this feeling of, oh my God, you know, they're asking me about books that I would love to do, but I'm removed from them at this point. And so, yeah, you do kind of grow away from it. Mm-hmm. And then the question becomes, do you even want to do it anymore? I mean, like, I had a book on the Jewish Sabbath that I really thought was a great book. And I'm not as immersed in Judaism as I used to be. And even though that book was going to be a secular book or morphed into a secular book, you know, I really have had to think about that. Would I ever really want to write that anymore? And I come back to the fact that, yeah, as a secular book, it's still very interesting to me and it's a great idea. But am I as immersed in that? No. So I think that when you're really excited about a topic, it's great to get something down on paper and not to walk away from it 100%. But it can be very hard for a writer to be working on more than one thing at a time, mm-hmm. right? So for me right now, my new strategy for this year, because I want to be doing more writing. I mean, I write all the time, blog posts and whatever, but in terms of books, I want to be writing more. And so my new strategy is to work on one book and finish it and then not wait. So typically I'd then start working on a book proposal, which is fine, but not to wait to start on something else and to just start on one of the other books, like the more spiritual ones, so that I feel like I am actually, you know, delving into those on a more regular basis, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because for me, a lot of times I'm not working on a book if I don't have a book to work on. And so I said, well, that's kind of crazy. I have like 20 books. I should be always working on a book, even if that book isn't going to be published for a little bit. So that's my new approach. But I don't think I'd be working on two at the same time. Mm-hmm. I could, but I don't think I would. Mm-hmm. Okay. Other questions? Great questions, ladies.
I work with a gentleman. His name is James. And it's basically nothing to do with personal development, things like that. But it's totally things I've worked with in the past. And he writes down ideas, 10 ideas every day. And when he gets to a certain point where he's done with one project, he builds companies. So he builds a company after the company's valued at $2 million, then he sells it and he starts. But he goes back to his list that he makes every day of ideas. And that got me into where now I take OneNote, and when I come up with an idea for a book or whatever I'm working on, I put it in, I set up like a binder in OneNote. And then every time a thought comes through, I put it there. So I'm able to keep going back into all these different categories and different areas and still keep it alive to some extent. And when the time is right, I like what he does, I can go back into it and say, now's the time. That's something I want to work on.
Yeah, and see, and that makes total sense. So you mean OneNote or do you mean Evernote?
I use OneNote because I think OneNote is cleaner. I do also use Evernote for business when I'm counseling, because Evernote's more reliable for pulling up my research and data off of my phone, because you just never know when you're going to need it and you don't have internet access. So I really like Evernote in that regard. So I use both.
Okay. Yeah, it was just I just wanted to make sure I was understanding.
But, yeah, OneNote is through Microsoft.
Okay. So I think that's a great idea. I think, you know, I was just talking to a fellow high-performance coach who works in a tech company, and they have these teams that just are constantly brainstorming new ideas. And so I think that it's really important to get your ideas down on paper somewhere or, you know, in the cloud, and then, yeah, be able to call on them. And it could be, you know, one idea is it turns out to be just a little PDF that you do, or it could turn out into something bigger, but at least they're recorded. And what I like about Evernote is just that then when you're online and you're looking at something, you can say, oh, wow, that really would go with that book. And you can clip it into Evernote and tag it so that you could find it, right?
Mm-hmm.
The same with Scrivener. Scrivener is really good that way. You can drag stuff from the internet right into a research binder on Scrivener, like in a project. So I tend to want to do it that way just so that everything's in one project.
Well, I think you can do that in OneNote. I mean, you can copy the URL address and put it into OneNote as well. I just struggle a lot with Evernote because it's not, to me, it's not clean. I can't just pull up one file and then have like all your tabs there and set. Everything's off to your left and it's just all thrown in together. Even when it comes to my research, and though it's listed as alphabetical order based on the diseases that they have and illnesses, it's always out of place.
Right.
So, I mean, it's in its right folder, but it's always getting jumbled up with the alphabet. So,
yeah. Well, I mean, we don't need to get into a big discussion about Evernote.
Yeah. So that's the only reason why I find OneNote a little bit cleaner.
Yeah, no worries. So, yeah, but that's a great suggestion. So just make sure we all keep track of our ideas so that we can go back to them when we're ready.
Yeah.
And I think then it's, you know, you go back and you look and you say, what do I feel passionate about right now? What would bring me joy to work on? Or what do I feel is of most service to my readers right now? Or if you want to approach it the way my literary agent would, he'd be saying, okay, you just published such and such book. What can you write now to support that book? So after the second edition of How to Blog a Book came out, or maybe it was the first edition, we did Blogging Basics for Authors. It was an ebook, but it promoted How to Blog a Book. Right? So there are all kinds of ways to look at those ideas and say, mm-hmm. you know, okay, this is what I'm going to do next. Good question. Other questions?
What do you think about the artist's way? I forget who the author is.
Julia Cameron?
Yeah, yeah. Have you used that or have any thoughts about it as a practice model?
Yeah, I think it's a great book. My issue with it is this. I see a lot of writers who come to me and say they have no time to write, but they're spending an hour doing morning pages. So I don't know how many of you have read The Artist's Way, but mm-hmm. it looks like everyone. I can't see Deborah, but yeah. And so I'm kind of like, okay, but you have an hour to do morning pages, but you don't have time to write your book? I mean, or a blog post? So for me, and maybe it's because I'm trained as a journalist, I just think that a professional writer, whether you're an author, you know, writing a blogger, it doesn't matter to me. If you want to be seen as a professional writer or see yourself that way, that this is going to be your career, I say sit on down and write and be productive, right? Now, I think that morning routines are enormously important. Me personally, I'm trying to get one back. But I see people being very successful with that. And that would include a lot of things, including morning pages, right? It could include meditation and exercise and reading and all kinds of things. If that floats your boat and it helps you get to the point of writing, awesome. But don't use it as an excuse not to write. Does that, you know, like, you know what I mean? Like as a procrastination.
Yes. Writing on our projects.
Yes. I think journaling is enormously important. I just, you know, for me, what will fall by, if I have deadlines and things that need to get written, then what falls by the wayside is journaling and all that other stuff, because I'm like, okay, I need to write. That's my priority. My priority is writing and my business. I want to have balance and all those things, but when there are deadlines approaching, then if I have to cut something out, it's going to be that. But I don't find that I do feel I need a morning routine, but I don't feel like I have to do all of that in order to be able to sit down and write. Does that make sense? You know, I'm not advocating giving up your morning routine when you have a deadline. I'm just saying for me. I just have taught myself that when I need to write, I sit down and I write. But I think, yeah, I have nothing against that book or the practice. I just don't want it used as an excuse or a way to procrastinate.
I think the artist way is a different category. The artist way is something I would send someone to in regards to dealing with the personal issue. Whereas your book on creative writing, I think it was called.
Creative Visualization for Writers.
Yes. That was the focus on writing. So you're literally talking about two different categories in my view of how you would use the books. One is about dealing with personal issues and writing and journaling to figure things out. The other one, yours, when I purchased yours and really looked at that, was about how to get into writing to write a book. So one's business, in my opinion. The other is personal development and dealing with personal issues.
Yeah, it's funny because I don't actually think of morning pages so much as personal issues. I see it as, and I haven't read it in years, but I always think of it as a way to just kind of do a brain dump and, you know, get yourself writing, but get a brain dump done so that it's not affecting your other writing. So, I mean, somebody can correct me if I'm wrong, but that's how I perceive it. Whereas Creative Visualization for Writers, had all the different sections. So there were places where you could do something just to generate the writing or to be thinking about your market or whatever it was. It was just more visually oriented, both towards, it was writing, drawing, and visualization. And it also had a personal development aspect. The whole first part was personal development.
Right, but it still leads you into business and writing.
Yeah.
This is Artist's Way, is the book I'm talking about. That one, I've always seen it more as just for personal. It's for your own health and for things you're dealing with. And I never saw Artist's Way as business. That's
it's
just
not
me.
Business, but I would disagree a little bit, respectfully. It's right here on my shelf. Because it's an empowering book for aspiring and working artists. With the basic principle that creative expression is a natural direction of life. 12-week program to recover your creativity from a variety of blocks, limiting beliefs, fear, sabotage, blah, blah, blah. So in that sense, it's totally personal development. But I think it's about getting you to write every day so that you could go on and be more creative and write other things. But that's just my interpretation. And again, it's been years since I used, I don't know, maybe Deanna has a different perspective. I'm not making you wrong, Linda. I'm just saying that's how I see it.
And maybe because I'm a counselor and I worked with people on emotional issues, that's how we used it. We focused on emotional issues.
Right. Yes. Yeah. And that would work great. Because if you're telling someone, you know, a client who's in counseling, you know, you should journal, it's a great book to give them.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And say, read this book and begin a journal. But for writers and other artists, it's more, to me, it's kind of a warm up. It's a warm up to your daily writing. Ella?
I have a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you for that. I have a question that kind of bridges Deanna's earlier question about mentors. and a continuing question about category and also strategy for my query letters. Because I don't have an agent yet, I need to do my own strategy. Could I start off with my query letters going to under the category of personal development? And then if I'm rejected, and it seems to be a pattern, could I switch my category and try a different strategy at a later time? This ties in with mentors because all of my mentors and my communities were in a different category, but I'm trying to break free from that into the mainstream because one of them, shamanism, is under attack by cultural appropriation, and that always really bothered me about that field. So I really don't want to be identified with that, and yet that's where all my mentors and background was, and I'm trying to break out of that, and I hope my work is doing that. Do you recommend that strategy where I start off in personal development, and if all else fails, then I go back?
So where are all of the shamanistic books? Where are they? I can't hear you.
Oh, unfortunately, they're under shamanism.
Okay, but so you didn't put yours under shamanism.
No.
So here's my biggest concern for you, and that is that when an agent looks at your competitive analysis and you say, here are my 10 top books or five top books, you know, in my competitive analysis, and they're all in personal development and you're not there, the question will be, why are you in a different category? Like, where are the books that are your competition that are in your category?
Okay.
But you could definitely approach agents and, you know, as I always say, don't send out, 20 queries at once. Send out 2 to 5 and wait to see what happens.
Okay.
Because remember, they know that you're a layperson. And so an agent, it's an agent's job to look at the proposal and say, this is an awesome proposal, but you got this wrong. Like, we need to redo this.
Okay. It took me a lot of courage to say that. Sometimes if I speak things, it dissipates the incredible amount of fear that I've built behind something.
Yeah, I get that.
I really don't like that category. I even today, I forced myself to pick up one of my competitive mentors. And I just really, it really bothers me. And I don't think I could have a career in that.
And that's fine. And I think if you want to be more mainstream, I would not put your book in the shamanism category at all.
Okay.
I really wouldn't.
Thank you.
I would go with personal development or health and wellness or something that's way more mainstream.
Okay. Thank
you. Just make sure your book fits there because you can't just pick. You just can't pick a category. It's got to actually make sense.
I've worked really hard on the languaging and all that for 20 years, actually. I've worked really hard to break out of that.
Okay, so good. So,
okay, thank you. I just needed to say it.
Yep, no worries. Happens. Yeah, so don't put it there.
Okay, all right. Okay.
All right, other questions? No, none? Well, we can call it a night, but if you have more questions, I'm willing to go for another 15 minutes.
I do have one.
Okay, Deborah.
It's Deborah again, but I don't know. If somebody else has something, you know, go for it.
Go ahead.
This goes back to branding. Mm-hmm. And what I intend to do is to split up my blogs and my main website into three, and I want a URL for all three of them. I don't want it blog. I want three separate URLs. So does it make sense? And I don't like my URL that is for my main, what's been my main site, which is art. So I was talking to my host, and I know how I can make this happen. But just as, and I'm not hindered by when somebody goes to my site, they see a different title. Like when they go to the site to see my writer's blog, it's my writer's life, okay? Mm-hmm. It's the URL that I'm after. So here's my ideas for the three URLs that would brand my name and show the different aspects. Deborah Lynn Art, Deborah Lynn Author, Deborah Lynn Caregiver, or whatever else I came up with for caregiver.
Okay. So, and now each one of those is going to reside somewhere separate. Is there going to be an umbrella site that people go to and then click through?
Every site will reference the other.
Okay.
So they'll all be linked back and forth.
Right. So mine are that way too, but I'm going to push you just a little bit, challenge you a little bit to think about having a site that's just DeborahLynn.com as well.
Oh, okay.
Where you then link to the other. So if you were to go look at NinaAmir.com, you will see that it links over to WriteNonfictionNow.com and to HowToBlogABook.com.
Right, right. I've been there.
Yes, separate sites.
The dancing and everything, yeah.
Yeah, and the dance one. Three totally separate sites. But how do you could find them on your own, right? Just by looking for Boys Who Dance or blogging books or blogging or, right, or nonfiction. You could find them. But if you know me,
right,
and you look for me,
right,
if I didn't have an umbrella site, right, you would find all these different sites and you go, oh my God, you know, what's going on? Whereas having that umbrella site, which if you can find an umbrella brand that goes over everything, then you can link right from there. And that way, as people know your name, they will find that site and then click through to what they need and want.
Okay, so because the other three would have Deborah Lynn and not my last name, because basically it just gets too long. I mean, it's just too long. Mm-hmm. On the search engine, if I had DeborahLynn.com and then Deborah Lynn Art, Deborah Lynn Author, Deborah Lynn Caregiver, it's all going to come up because of my name. Mm-hmm. I'm branding my name.
Right. But if they want to know where to go to find everything you do, it's nice to have that umbrella site.
Exactly.
Because I told you, that's, you know, I had all those sites too. And I looked like a multiple personality to most people, mm, right? But by creating NinaAmir.com and creating a brand that went with all of it, then I had a cohesive whole.
Right.
So it's like a puzzle with, you know, once the puzzle's all together, you go to NinaAmir.com and then you can break out the pieces. Does that make sense?
Exactly. And so then as far as the brand, it's okay. The brand is DeborahLynn.com.
Yes.
And the way it all ties together is the art, the creative arts is used with the caregiving, which I'm also writing about.
Yeah, but I would be looking for something that, like a tagline. I have somebody else I've been working with in the Author of Change program, and she actually is a shaman. And she worked on a tagline, and she actually has one on her site. She actually has two on her old site. But she finally came up with, like, dream, draw, write. And so it'd be the same kind of thing for you. You know, you got to come, like, mine is, you know, with Nina, you achieve more inspired results. But, you know, and I have the whole inspiration to creation thing. But if you have something that encompasses everything you do, that when they land on that DeborahLynn.com page, that's going to help people know how you can help them. And it may not be caregiving. It may not be, you know what I mean? It's something that, it's a thread that ties it all together.
Yeah, because when we talked about my tagline being advocating or advocate, mm-hmm, that's just for the caregiving.
Okay.
So I need to figure out something that ties all three. And what did you just say? What was hers?
Hers was dream, draw, write, because she's a active dreaming teacher and stuff. And active dreaming is where she starts, and then she goes on to, she's an artist and she's a writer.
Okay. All
right. She realized that is her framework. Dream, draw, write. That's what she does.
Yes. Yes. Okay.
Right. So that works for
her.
That's great. Go back and look at my other sites and you will see that every one of them uses the word inspire or inspiring.
Okay.
Right. Because I'm inspiring people to create something. So if we were to go, I don't know how fast I can get there, but you know, NinaAmir.com, it's obviously inspiration to creation coach, helping you achieve more inspired results. Hold on, I gotta log in.
Okay, so tag a word.
Yeah.
Repeat the word.
On the boys' blog, hold on, I gotta go home. I gotta log into all these sites. Hang on. Okay, so on how to blog a book, still not quite there, sorry. Okay, on how to blog a book, it's in the banner, it says how to blog a book, inspiring you to build visibility, boost authority, and become an author post by post.
Okay, so basically I've got to come up with a word that can help tie everything together.
Yeah, so, you know, and that one used to just be, you know, something like help, you know, I can't remember, something about post by post, but yeah, and write nonfiction now, after I did all my branding, it now says, it actually goes more along with the author of change, inspiring you to make a positive, meaningful difference with your words.
Okay.
Right? And then the boys blog, I'm actually not seeing it there anymore, but it was something like inspiring, you know, you to achieve your dancing dreams. I can't remember. Anyway, but you get the idea.
Point well taken. That's super. Thank you.
Yep.
Is anybody in our group think that's corny? What I've just presented with the three different aspects?
Nope. Sherry says no. Ella's nodding no. Linda's nodding no.
It doesn't sound corny. The way you presented it sound like it could be difficult to manage three distinct sites, but
there are three distinct already.
Oh.
Yeah, she's already got them.
Oh.
Which is exactly where I was, Deborah. I was right there.
Yeah.
Three sites, how the heck do I make it make sense to my, you know, to somebody who shows up?
Exactly.
And that's all it is. It's an umbrella site over everything that then leads to the others. And then the others lead back.
Right. Very good.
Something that makes it cohesive. Something that brings it all together.
That's wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Other questions before we end? No? I'll give you a second to think.
Okay, well, do you think we should include photos in our books?
So photos cost money to reproduce. Mm-hmm. So do images. As I was writing my sample chapters to Author of Change, I created a few little images, you know, like using word art, not word art, but, you know, words art thing, and one in PowerPoint. And my agent immediately came back and, you know, when he sent me my proposal back for changes and said, you need to put in here how many images you're going to have, because the publisher wants to know, because it costs them money. Even if they're simple black and white, you know, or grayscale, they want to know that because it costs money. So images, like photos, much more expensive. Yeah. If you want to include them, you can. It's easier in an ebook. They're not going to cost you anything in an ebook.
Oh.
But do know that it's hard in an ebook to place images because the text just scrolls. And so you have to have a really good book formatter for, you know, Kindle type formatter to make sure that your images show up where you want them to be.
Mm-hmm.
Other questions? Nope. Okay. Then we meet for our last session next week, same day, same time. And, you know, even if you're not caught up on the homework, it'd be great if you just scanned through or watch the webinars if you could, or just scan through anything just so that you have a big picture view of where we started and where we're ending up. This month was all about, you know, writing the marketable book. I talked all about the book proposal process, you know, using the business plan as a way to evaluate yourself and your book. I talked about self-publishing, traditional publishing. So, you know, this is the month of, you know, how are you going to get that work out there? Okay, and you will be getting an email. I think it might have been Sherry asked me, what do we do next after this? You will be getting an email hopefully tomorrow or the next day about the Write Your Transformational Book Challenge. Starts in July. It's 3 months of writing. I give you checklists. Every month you get one checklist with things to go through. The first one you get early, as soon as you register, you get the first one so that you can start working on it, because it has to do with what we've done here this last month. It has to do with, you know, knowing your market, knowing your competition, doing the kind of analysis and planning of your book so that you're ready to write, right? And then the idea is, if you're going to write a full-length book, which you don't have to, but if we're looking at about a 60,000-word nonfiction book, then we're writing 700 words a day. So it's not a lot. That's like less than 3 typed double-spaced pages, right? So if your book is shorter, if you're writing a novel and it's going to be shorter, it's, you know, whatever. It doesn't matter. You just, you know, pick. I teach you how to figure out how many words you need to write every day, and that's what you do. And we meet every other week to talk about whatever issues you have. It could be things like this about publishing, or it doesn't matter to me. It's open author coaching, just like this. But you know, we're also, there's a lot of high performance work that goes on there, because we're talking about people being stuck. I'm not writing, life got in my way, you know, and the idea here is to try to get a first draft done in 3 months' time. Now, if that's not where you want to go right now, that's fine. And maybe you just want to take a break from me altogether, and that's fine. But the other thing is for you to join, I think you all got a free Nonfiction Writers University membership, but to actually upgrade to the master's level. Okay, I can't remember if y'all got a free membership. Does anybody remember?
Yes, we did.
Given access to that.
Yeah. Okay, so you could just use your Nonfiction Writers University for the next 6 months and, you know, get lots of information in there, show up at all the events, there's coaching, or you can upgrade it, which means you do have to pay. But you can upgrade it and become actually at this point an early adopter in my master's level to the Nonfiction Writers University. And what you get there is, so in the Nonfiction Writers University, if you haven't been using it, Deanna, you may not know, but there's, Ella comes to a lot of things. She was there with me today. We have an educational training every month. So I either do a training myself or somebody comes in, we do them live. Then we have a virtual writing session. You get a checklist every month that goes with the training. And then you also get a video training, like pre-recorded, that's related. So we have the educational event, the checklist, and a video training that all kind of go together. It wasn't always like that, but it is now. And then you also get author coaching. But if you join at the master's level, which right now I'm still taking early adopters to that because it's brand new, on top of all that other stuff, you get high-performance coaching. So the high-performance writer, charged writer, all that type of stuff, 2 years worth of it. So right now I have a year and a half, but I will have 2 years of it. So we're doing that every other week. Then, so there's the high performance coaching, then there's author training. So I took the author training manual and created a curriculum. And so we have an 8-week curriculum. And what's going to happen with all this coaching is, so the high performance coaching, because right now I have 36 sessions, every other week we go and we'll just keep going until we run out. Then we'll go back to the beginning again. And you can come in at any time. They've been recorded. We've already done 2 sessions, actually. The author training is only 8 weeks. So after 8 weeks, we'll go back to the beginning. And we'll do it again. So you can attend, you can not attend. And then there's also authorpreneur coaching. So for those of you who want to learn how to make money with your writing and your books, that's the focus there. On top of that, there's one more, what I'm calling office hours, but it's just open author coaching like this. Bring your questions and I answer. So you get 4 more, you know, 4 more events, kind of, one of them's pre-recorded, but 4 more events, and you get that high, that personal development work, and you get the author training as well. So I this is kind of the best I can offer to anyone. So if that's of interest to you, you know, let me know if you haven't seen the emails or something, let me know. I'll send you a link so you can look at it. But that's, and right now as early adopters, you get some say on when things happen, like times and days. So I'm starting to ask questions about that to the members. And also you're going to get in at the lowest price it'll ever be. So it's $97 a month right now. And as soon as I have 20 people in at the early adopter, it's going to jump. So this is the time to get in. And if you, you know, you can always go back. If you don't like it, we'll give you back your free membership to the university till it runs out. Okay.
Send the link, Nina. I haven't seen that yet.
Yeah. Do you want me to put it in the chat or do you want me to send it to you?
Can you send it to me, not in the chat?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Yep. Any questions about any of that before we hang up? No? Okay. So I just wanted to reiterate it because Sherry had asked about it, I think, last time or the time before. So, and with only one session left. So that's, you know, I just want to push you to get everything in that you can. So if you don't want to do any of those things or you're just going to stay in the university, that's fine. You still get access to me every month without fail. And, you know, and you've got that for actually another 9 months because you've, this was a 3-month program. So you'll have 9 more months in the university and that's fine. If that's what you want to do, there's no pressure here. I just want to be of service and I want to make sure that when you come back next week, you've looked over things and you come back with questions about this course so that I can answer them for you before we're done.
Nina, we all received a conference call with you, a one-on-one conference call in right. our package. And I haven't taken mine yet. I just haven't felt ready. Mm-hmm. So when does that expire?
I usually ask that you do that within 30 days of the program ending.
Okay.
Okay. So 30 days from next week.
Okay.
Yeah.
Got it. I mean, thank you.
I don't keep really close track, Deborah. You know, if it was 5 weeks later, I'm not going to like say you can't have it, but
okay.
Easier for me to kind of knock them off and get them done and, you know that they've been done. Has anybody done them with me? See how good my records are?
Nope.
Nope. Okay.
So basically by mid-July, we yeah. need to be setting up our conference call.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and I am gone for a week from the 18th to the 25th. I'm not around of this month, just so you all know. And then I'm around most of July. So I would just say try to get it done before the end of July at the latest.
Okay.
Because then August gets a little crazy. Okay?
Okay, good.
We good?
Good.
All right. Yep. So I hope, Deanna, you'll come back next week with any questions you have. So I feel like I've supported you. And Melinda's work stuff going on, and Deanna told me she's buying a house and at work and all mm-hmm. kinds of things. So no worries. Just come back and say goodbye at least and ask your final questions. Okay. All right. Thank you all. Really great questions tonight. I will talk to you next week. And until then, go out and do something so that you achieve more inspired results by using your words to make a difference. Okay. Do something.
That's great.
Thank all you, right. everyone.
Bye, everyone.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.